Who the Wild Things Are with Ryan McGuire.
You gotta listen to your body.
Oh my God, maybe, you know, I could get out there. I could do this.
Let's take a ride. Find your wild side. Real stories. See with your own eyes.
It's so beautiful.
I'm gonna have the best time out here.
Yeah, I was in tears. I was like, that's the best, man.
Welcome back to Who the Wild Things Are. My name is Ryan McGuire, and I'm here to bring you conversations with the most wild folks on the planet. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you enjoyed the episode, share it with a friend. Appreciate you guys. Let's get it going. All right, Don, welcome back. It's been a while. I would suggest that if anyone hasn't seen episode 29, definitely go back and check out 29 and learn a little bit of the background about who Don is and all the crazy stuff you've done.
We got into some deep stuff that first conversation. That was one of my favorite podcasts I've ever been on.
I think Lauren says it's number one on of 46 crazy, interesting people. I think Lauren says that episode 29 ranks top.
Heck yeah. I always like being number one. So, you know, pick a metric and I'm going to try to be the best at it.
Speaking of number one, just coming off a fresh victory at the 24-Hour World Championships. Talk to me.
National Championships.
Not world. Gosh.
That's maybe
silly me
to come.
National Championships.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. How was that race for you? And what does that mean in terms of like significance in the ultra running world?
I won the United States track and field overseas running, right, official. So they put on the 24-hour national championship and went out to Arizona just mid-November and won. Right, so the premise is 24 hours on it was a 0.98 mile loop. So, and then it's pretty simple from there. Whoever runs the furthest wins.
So you're just going around a track over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, and USATF rules ban headphones.
Okay.
So another step, and this is a huge advantage me. I think I'm a more talented mental athlete than I am a physical athlete. So no, you can't have any headphones on, no stimulus or anything like that. So you're literally just going around the same circle over and over and over and over again with nothing to think about but running, unless you have strong mental strategies.
Gotcha. So on that, are you allowed to play music out loud or no? Because I know
you can't have a communication device at all on you.
Sweet.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
There's no gray area there. You just can't have a phone on you.
Sick.
I think it was a huge advantage me. Another huge advantage me was the weather was quite terrible in the morning. It rained the first 4 or 5 hours, pretty hard. And so, you know, you're running for 24 hours and you're starting just soaking wet.
Oof.
So I was actually probably the only guy in the entire field that was like, yes, like bring on the just despicable, nasty weather. Because again, it doesn't bother me mentally. And I could see a few of my competitors were not thrilled about it. I'm like, whatever. Like, you're going to run for 24 hours no matter what. You're going to go through some ups and downs. Like, who cares? And they were letting it get to their heads. And so I had a bunch of confidence in hour one. Not that I thought I had already won, but like, I'm already miles ahead of these other people who are letting this weather get to them.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty good start for me, being that it was a bad weather day.
You wanted a dogfight is what you're saying. You wanted it to be the most miserable thing, because when it comes to talent, there might be people as fast as you, but when it comes to mental fortitude, you feel like that's where you
100%
can out advantage them.
I think every success in my career has come from being mentally stronger than most people in the space. And it takes a lot to run 100 miles. You know this. Like, I'm not saying anybody that finishes 100 plus miles is mentally weak.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I have spent a lot of time training that space, so I have a bunch of mental strategies that when one doesn't work, I can switch to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as having a bunch of different pairs of shoes. If one is starting to bother you, you can put on a different pair of shoes. If one mental strategy isn't working for me, I can switch gears, and all of a sudden I have a new mental strategy that's going to keep me moving through the middle of the night when it's dark, you're cold, and you know your stomach doesn't feel good, but I'm focusing on you know, counting, there was a highway not too far away. I was counting headlights, right? Like, I don't care at that point what mile I'm at, what lap I'm at, my pace. I just want to keep moving forward and focus on anything but the fact that I'm still running.
Wow. That's, I can imagine getting to the place where you're counting headlights. But for most people, that equates to I'm wasting my time. Yeah. Right. And they get that little creep of doubt and like, I'm not supposed to be here. What am I doing this for? And they kind of lose sight of the mission.
Yeah.
But it seems like you have kind of a whole nother layer of experience with this.
Well, to me, do I want to be hyper focused on at hour 16, the fact that I have 8 hours of running to go, or do I want to find literally anything? So perfect examples, before it got dark, it was, hey, this loop, I'm going to look for everything that's blue.
Wow.
I'm going to look for everything that's red. Or the next lap, I'm going to count trees. Like, it doesn't matter what that thing is to me. It's just anything to bide the time mentally, because as soon as you focus on, and you've been through it, right? Like, at hour 12 of 24, like, that is a monumental task to think about, holy crap, I'm already hurting and I have the same amount that I've already done left. That's I think a losing strategy. It is for me anyways.
Yeah.
And so I just look for anything dumb to think about. My crew also will tell me like brain teasers, because you run past your crew every mile, right? And so like they would give me dumb jokes, stuff that, you know, just really silly things to think about. And I have about 9 minutes to come back and tell them what the answer might be. And so it's just anything like that. You try to have some fun with it. At some point you're not going to have fun, but you have to find ways to make it fun.
Yeah. I also, it gets harder in later parts of ultras, but in the beginning of ultras, once the beginning settles in, like the beginning, there's a bunch of hype and everyone's excited, and then that fades and you have like kind of this middle thing. I'll kind of pick like maybe like 4 or 5 people that are like close to me in my life. And I'll just be like, all right, I'm going to think about them for an hour or two and just 100%. Like think about my relationship with them. Like, am I thankful for them? Or is it someone that I need to kind of move out of my life and just like pick out a couple people that are on my heart and just be like, okay, for the next hour, I'm just going to think about so-and-so and use that to get past the hour and also kind of get some thinking done that any other time in life, there's too much stimulus to actually like,
this is your time. Capacity. I've done the same thing. I found 24 people to dedicate 24 hours to when I was on the treadmill. It's a great strategy. And it's not always, it's funny because it's, for me, it's not always like people I'm close to. It's sometimes it's like people that hurt me in my past.
Yeah.
Like people that really, that I just want to stick up a middle finger to and be like, you bet against me. Like, this is what's up now.
Yeah.
And it's just like that fuels the fire too.
Yeah.
For sure. Like I've had a lot of people bet against me in my life, and I remember every single one of them. And every time I go out and do something or win a race, like at some point in that race, that person's name is on my mind.
It's like Goggins, I will turn your ass into a mixtape.
Yeah, it's like Billy Madison, like that dude that kept the list of people,
right? Oh yeah, he's like crossing them off.
Yeah, it's like you know, his list that I think people to kill. It's like, I don't want to hurt them, but they don't even know that they motivate me.
Oh my gosh, that's such a great parallel, Billy Madison. I never even thought of it. Oh gosh, that's so good. So talk me about the low points of the 24 hour, because no matter how strong you are, like you always go through some shit that feels insurmountable.
Yeah. And in you know, we just talked on the tiny bench just a bit ago about this, and you said the exact same thing that I would say here, is like, it's, you're going to go through low points, but as long as you're staying out, you're staying moving, like that's what you're there to do. And so there were definitely some low points that I came in and like I just hugged my wife and I cried. I was just like, I literally told her, I said, there is nothing, I don't know the exact what I said in the moment, but I was like, there's nothing I want to do less than go out and keep running right now, but it's exactly what I'm going to keep doing. Right? You get to those moments, you're like, I do not want to be doing this, but I'm going to.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think for me, it's just being real with the emotions, right? Like, you're feeling it, like, have that cry. Like, I don't care. So I hugged my wife, I hugged my mother-in-law, who was my two crew there. And then got back out there. Mm-hmm. I stayed in that fight and it just kept moving forward. And even if in 24-hour type racing, fixed time racing, as long as you're moving forward, you're making progress. So it's like, hey, start with a walk. Walk could turn into a run.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily for me, so this is my first official 24-hour format. I didn't know like the racing strategy of it and things like that. So it was a big learning curve. But lucky for me, when things got really, really tough, I was in a position where I pretty much knew I couldn't lose the race because I was up a couple miles on second place and he was walking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of gave myself that permission to like, hey, as long as if he's walking. And this is kind of one of the regrets I have from the race is like I took my foot off the gas a little bit. I was like, oh, second place is walking. I can walk. So I walked for a couple hours. And looking back, that, you know, I'm a little disappointed at that.
Mm.
But still, like I strategically, I'm like, well, if he runs, I run. If he walks, I walk. Like I can give myself this little bit of permission. I was having some hip flexor issues. The rain caused a little bit of a hot spot on my foot and I knew it changed my gait just enough that later in the race, my hip flexor was wonky and I was looking for any reason to not run at that point. And
naturally. So
when he was walking, I was like, okay, I'm going to give myself permission to walk for a little bit. And then that walk probably lasted longer than I would have liked. It didn't turn into a run, but eventually it came back to a run and then that run, as soon as the sun comes up on these things, like, oh, you're a new person.
It's like taking like ecstasy. You're just like, oh my gosh.
It is like the greatest feeling when you're suffering in misery and it's not a lit loop. So like I'm wearing a headlight and like just, you're just kind of over it. It got a little chilly. And then the sun comes up and it's like, okay. And then I started running again. And that run turned into like emptying the tank at the end. And this is cool. Like I have some pictures or video of like, I was running 6:30s the last 20 minutes.
Shut up.
Just open up the throttle. Cause at that point I was 10 miles up on second place. And I was like, if I try this and I fall off the side of the path, like I still win. Like,
yeah. You're still going to win.
It's zero cost at this point. You just empty the tank. It started as like one, I was going to do one hard, like really hard lap, you know, last one, fast one, just like see if, cause it'd be funny just to say my fastest lap of the day was mile like 127 or something like that. And it felt really good and I was going to stop. And then, so they have a USATF official out there and then a bunch of other people, they're like, keep going. You've got like 15 more minutes, like don't stop. And so I did another lap. I was like, all right, one more. And then that lap felt so good. I just kept going.
Wow.
They give you at the end, they give you like this little flag. And so whenever the 24 hours is up, they blow air horns all around the mile loop. And whenever you're done, you just stick your flag in the ground and mm-hmm. they measure to that point.
Oh, okay.
And that's how they know exact distance.
Gotcha.
I just sent it. I just opened up the throttle. It felt so good.
It's amazing. So in total, what was your total distance after the 24?
Yeah, so it was 127.2.
Is that the furthest you've ever done in 24 hours?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing. No athlete's ever happy once you get done and look back, right? But I wanted a lot more. And this is where I kind of regret the walking. But I was going in thinking I could put up, and I still am 100% confident I can, but the like 145 to 155 range is my 24-hour target going forward.
Okay, cool. So how does this progress? Like, is there another level, like a world level after this?
Yeah, so the qualifying window for the U.S. world team is now open. So the world championships happened just last weekend.
Okay.
So my race didn't qualify for that, which is another reason I didn't really have this carrot in front of me to go for a really, really big number.
Right.
So now that the U.S. World 24-hour World Championship team qualification window is open, the U.S. men's standard is 145 miles.
Okay.
And they take the top six. Last year, or this most recent, and the World Championships are every 2 years.
Okay.
The most recent team, I think the lowest distance was like 149 or something miles.
Wow.
To get onto the team, up to, you know, the men's American record was set last December at 172 miles.
Who did that?
Nick Corey.
Okay.
It's like 820 pace for 24 miles.
So gross.
Or 24 hours. Yeah, it's
disgusting,
unbelievable. And that's not even touching the world record, which is 198 miles, which was just set last year as well by this guy, this Lithuanian guy, Alexander Sorokin.
He's got the 100K too, right?
100K, 100 mile, 24 hour.
That guy's a freak.
He's, a, I mean.
His 100K, so like 60 miles, it was something like a 550 pace.
Yeah, it's unreal.
I was like, or maybe it was a
it's something
6 minute pace.
Crazy.
Same unbelievable.
With, same with his 100 mile time. It's like 650 pace or something like that. Or
unbelievable.
Yeah, he's a freak. He's if he keeps and he's not a young. He's I think he's 43 or 44, but he works hard and he is the poster boy for strength training as an endurance athlete.
Let's
like,
go.
Like yeah,
my dog.
Yeah, I love it, man. Like talk about an inspiration for me because I'm a big advocate for strength training as a runner. And I look at that guy. He's like, dang, like that guy is literally the best that has ever lived doing it. And he's you know deadlifting and squatting heavy and got upper body strength and
really
yeah.
Okay.
Like he's I mean he's built like you. Like he's a big bigger stronger dude.
Sweet. That makes me feel a little bit better.
Yeah, man.
Because when I show up to these races, I'm like, I think I'm in the wrong sport.
Yeah.
I think I went to the wrong place. Is the wrong address?
I've got, I mean, I'm even big for, yeah. Right, for an ultra runner. I've got upper body strength.
Yeah, definitely. Man. Yeah, you look at a lot of the elite guys, like I think of like Walmsley or like Harvey Lewis, like a lot of those guys, they look like kind of like that high school cross country body.
Yeah, oh,
like,
yeah.
Loose penny. Like super skinny and super efficient, and yep. I just am not any
same.
Of those.
I've never been that. I've always had a little extra, looks a little extra weight on me, so I've just leaned into it. It's yeah. Like if I'm going to be heavier than you, I'm going to be a lot stronger than you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something in terms of like the amount of beating your body can take. Like there has to be some advantage to not being super skinny.
Yeah, and for me, I never. Felt great as a high mileage runner. Mm. So
that's such a funny thing to hear you say.
Well, compared to other like elite ultra runners who are running 120 to 140 miles a week, I might be at 80, yeah. 80 to 85 a week, but I do strength training 3 days a week and I do mobility work 3 to 4 days a week. And so it's like, you don't have to destroy your body out on the roads if you're doing other stuff to be strong as well. And then the mental stuff obviously too helps. So when my body might be a little bit weaker at the end of a race compared to somebody else, I just turn it off and just go.
If you could give one piece of advice relating to mindset to somebody that's like doing their first ultra, what would you say?
Don't fixate on the big picture. Create micro goals for yourself during. So we've talked about, right, dedicating an hour to somebody in a 24 hour, but look at the only race that matters in front of you is from this aid station to the next aid station.
Mm.
You cannot get to the finish without getting to that next aid station first. So create goals for yourself. Okay. And if you have a terrible stretch that like, man, like that aid station to aid station, that was just awful. I felt terrible. I threw up. I, whatever, like it's a new race. Once you get to that next aid station, you can reset all of a sudden. Okay. That was that section. Like, that wasn't me. That was that section. Moving on. Change your shoes. Whatever. Mm. It's a new race every single time. Because if you stand at the start line of a 100-mile race and you're like, wow, I have 100 miles to go.
Mm.
That's hard. It's hard to really picture that. But if you're saying, hey, I get a snack in 5 miles. And then at that point, you're like, okay, I get to see my wife in another 5 miles. And then it's like, oh, there's a really cool aid station with really sweet tunes playing another 5 miles. Then it's just 5 miles at a time. And then how many times in your life have you run 5 miles?
Yeah.
That's easy to think about. 100 miles is so hard to think about. Even I've done it 18 times now. I've run 100 miles or more. And I still to this day, I cannot fathom at the start line running 100 miles. I have to think, okay, just 6 miles to go to snacks.
Mm. That's a great way to think about it. And I think one thing that comes with that is like it feels you start to think that it's like dangerous, right? Like the way I'm feeling right now, if I think about the entire goal of 100 miles or 60 miles left, that feels dangerous. But in reality, it's just discomfort. And at this point, like, we live so comfortably that there's this like blurred line, this confusion between discomfort and danger. And it's like, sure, your feet hurt, but like, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
Your body has this amazing regenerative ability. Like, it literally can fix itself on the go. But we have this like conditioning now that, oh my God, my feet are hurt. I need to stop right now or something's going to go terribly wrong. Yeah. And you go through ultras and you realize like, no, that was just discomfort.
Totally. And you can run 3 to 5 miles in discomfort. I don't want to run 60 miles in discomfort.
Sure.
So if you're focused on that 60 miles to go and you're uncomfortable, man, that's a losing mindset for sure. Like, but okay, just got to get to that aid station. It'll reset.
Yeah. And just let your let yourself know. And I guess it's easy for us to say because we've done this now, but like a lot of times you give yourself an hour and you feel great in the next hour. But if you're in the beginning stages, you don't know that you're going to feel better. You think there's no way this is going to get better. It could only get worse from here. And honestly, especially you were talking about with the sun, like it usually always gets better.
Yeah, it will. It's going to be like, you're not as good as your highest of moments and you're not as bad as your lowest of moments in an ultra, because you're going to feel incredible. Like at some point that euphoria kicks in and you're like, hell yeah, this is the greatest day of my life. Like, you know, that's not reality. And neither is like, oh, I'm miserable and everything sucks and I'm not going to finish. Like, that's not reality either. Like, it's, you're somewhere in between.
Mm. You just got to kind of acknowledge those moments.
Yeah. I mean, the top of the wave is exciting as hell. And I like ride that as hard as you can. Let it keep going. The other thing I'll say with that is a lot of times for a lot of people, that lowest of lows coincides with either dehydration or lack of calories.
Yeah, fueling.
So you can get yourself out of it, which it's a slippery slope too, because when you get in that mindset, you don't want to eat usually. And so, like, just force yourself to sip on some calories, take in something, and it'll bring you out of it a little bit quicker.
Do you have any, like, secret go-tos as being a pro ultra runner that most of us aren't doing in terms of fuel?
I mean, if I'm coming into an aid station and it's just what's at the aid station and I'm feeling grumpy, it's Coca-Cola all day.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like I would pick up a Coke normally, but, like, it's sugar and it's caffeine.
Yeah.
And it's two stimulants that are gonna go, but I find for my mindset, the best bang for my buck is Ketone IQ. Mm-hmm. I know everybody's probably seen it on social media floating around, but I find that has really helped me stay focused on my goals. And, you know, so I just mix it in with my water bottles and sip on it. I don't take the full shots.
That's kind of psycho, because that stuff tastes worse than anything I've ever had in my life. It's the worst taste.
It tastes like what I imagine like a kerosene tastes like or something like that. It's bad, but it's rough. I find it to be worth it.
Here's my fear with Ketone IQ, and you can tell me if this is reasonable or not. It works too well.
Okay.
I would say in life, generally anything that is that easy and works that well and can put you at another octane without having to put any work or any research or a lot of money into it, like, it seems hard for me to believe that I can just like infuse ketones into my brain, drop in a moment's notice to anything I'm doing and have no repercussions in the long term.
Yeah, I would say that's a fair argument, but there are other areas of life that you can get free benefits too. I mean, look at the research on going from 6 hours of sleep a night to 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. You can become a much more productive person by adding more sleep. And that's free. That's low cost. It's just time. So I definitely agree with you. You're adding a chemical to your brain and like what is happening. So I don't use it day to day a ton for that, but racing, right?
Like,
Everything legal goes in racing.
Yeah.
And I say that's a very important distinction, right? Like there are boundaries I will never consider crossing. But if there's a legal way for me to have some kind of an advantage or some kind of an extra benefit, I'm going to take it, man.
Like, absolutely.
Like, who wouldn't?
Yeah, no.
And I've seen huge benefits. Longer the race, the more benefit I see out of Ketone IQ.
Interesting.
Because I don't lose interest in the activity at hand.
But you're also dripping it.
I am slow dripping it. A 2.5. So one of those shots, if you think about the shot of Ketone IQ, it's 10 grams of ketones.
Okay.
So I will do 2.5 grams per hour.
Yeah, so
it's very, very slow small. Drip.
So, yeah, I guess that's the distinction. It's the same way you use caffeine in ultras versus caffeine in like an hour. Because like High Rocks, I'll just rip one of those beforehand and I'm in like 20 minutes, I'm so
But that's an hour, in. Right? You can your candle can burn bright in an hour.
I'm down to crash. I want to crash afterwards. 100%. I want to get across that line and I want everything to be...
To stay on the stage.
Yeah, just lay on the stage and cry.
Lights out.
But I've never tried the slow drip method.
It's worked really well for two reasons. One, it doesn't taste as bad. But two, I find that slow drip allows me, because if you've done an ultra, you know, there are moments you get behind on calories, you go into an aid station, and what is aid station food? It's like stoner food. It's like gummy bears and candy and Oreos, and that's fine. It's sugar. But you're going to take handfuls of sugar, and what does sugar do? It inflames your body. It's stuff we don't want as ultra athletes. And so the other benefit that I found, other than, you know, keeping mentally in, is I'm actually recovering faster because I don't hit those lows of needing to like pound sugar at aid stations. And so I'm able to stay on my fueling a little bit better, and then I don't have nearly as much inflammation the next day, and I feel better. So I don't know. I haven't really talked to many other athletes about that, but I've seen a noticeable difference in like how I eat during an ultra and how I recover after since I've added Ketone IQ. And I've been using it for just over a year now.
I am very like, I want everyone to know that's listening to this. My opinion about this is very ignorant. So I'm just saying from the limited times I've tried it, what I feel.
And not everybody feels anything. Like, I think that's really something that's important. I think it's like 10 or 15% of people that see no benefits.
They don't feel it?
They don't feel anything.
Oh, dude, feel it like very visceral.
That shocks me. And then there are some people that, and I would argue that the people that don't feel it are probably in this bucket more than anything. There are some people that need a ton to feel anything. They need like 30 grams of ketones in 10 minutes to feel as locked in as you and I might.
That makes that, like, Lauren would probably be like that. Like, she'll drink like a huge coffee and feel nothing. Yeah. Or like she just doesn't know, like doesn't feel the difference in a lot of things, versus if I take a little bit of something, I'm usually like, oh my God,
wired.
Let's go. So yeah. That makes a lot of sense. My concern is, like, the way I think about ketones, everything I think about is like evolution of man, right? Like, okay. We were kind of like a hunter-gatherer situation. Yeah. It's kind of hard to find carbs. So a lot of what we're doing in the woods is seeking animal protein.
Right.
And with animal protein comes concentrations of fat, fat being the most important macronutrient. So we're eating protein, we're eating fat, and we're fueling that way, and we're creating ketones because we're not eating bread in the bush. Like, correct. Where are you going to get the bread?
Yeah.
It's not there.
Exactly.
So then your body's creating ketones, which give you mental clarity and like this ability to focus and continue to hunt and gather and move and do all those things that made us human, right? It's like this evolutionary concept that allowed us to propel forward as a race. What scares me is like now we're able to tap into that whenever we want.
Yeah, it's a cheat code.
You could be playing video games. You're not chasing a bear. You're looking at a computer screen and you can literally tap into that like primal hunter-gatherer superpower.
100%. That's why I think for me, I'm not willing to wake up and use it every single day. I know people that use it like before they like, okay, I log into work at 8 a.m. I got to take my ketone shot.
Really?
I'm not quite there yet with it. If I have like a really important presentation I need to put together and I have 6 hours to do it, hell yeah, I'm taking a ketone shot.
Yeah.
I call it liquid blinders. Like, it's going to keep me and my ADHD brain from
wandering off. It's almost like an Adderall.
Totally.
It's like dropping into one task.
But you're right. I think we are definitely evolving and finding ways to like maybe cheat the body a little bit from where we came. We started as, you know, what, 10,000 years ago as keto-based athletes. Obviously, they didn't know what that meant then, but I think everybody that hears that now knows what that means, right? High fat, low carb. And I think for me, I'm not a keto athlete. I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm more of an intuitive athlete that gets a ton of protein.
Yeah.
But ketone IQ allows me to tap into that other fuel source without totally changing my life and diet.
I think that's an important distinction, is like you can now have ketones and carbs.
And, yeah.
You can have both. That's the
I'm a dual fuel athlete, or dry fuel if you want to say, because at some point you burn fat, carbs, and now ketones. So I have three fuels at any moment that I can burn.
Yeah, I want to see some data on it. I want to know. I want to use it.
Yeah.
I was so skeptical. I was like, I'm not going to feel this. Like, this is like, because I'm very skeptical of snake oil salesmen. Like,
totally. And I was too.
Like, I think like most of what we are trying to do with like all of this biohacking stuff, you can do by getting a lot of sunlight,
living healthier,
getting a lot of rest, eating better. Whole foods, yeah. Walking barefoot. Like, yeah. That's what the EMF and the cold plunge and the sauna and everything is trying to emulate, is just being outside.
Yes.
It's literally just emulating, oh, it's really hot out, or it's really cold out, or, yeah, you know.
It's stripping away electronics and processed crap, and like, it's just getting us back to where we were before really modern technology.
Yeah, spending a bunch of money on devices to get us back to step one.
That is pretty funny. I was like, just go hang out outside for a little bit. Go sit in the snowbank.
Yeah, wear one less layer out and be like a little bit cold. And 100%. Just be like okay with being cold for
a bit.
That's
what I've always done. Like, I hate cold plunging. I love how I feel after the cold plunge, but I have never been like comfortable in a cold plunge. Yeah. And I'm super comfortable going out when it's 20 degrees in shorts and a t-shirt and running for 3 hours. Like,
yeah,
where the difference is, I don't know, but it's really interesting.
It is. And it takes time. I think we were talking about this earlier because you came over, that we just got done with a cold track session. We get back to the house, everyone's in the cold plunge. So it takes time to adapt. And I think the problem is a lot of people start too cold. Like, they go like all the way
35 degrees,
freezing.
Yeah.
It's their first cold plunge, and they're like, that was way too much. Yeah. Like, I'm freaking out. Like,
well, the Silberg principle says that like 58 degrees is fine. Like, mm-hmm. You get all the benefits at 58 degrees as you'll get at, you know, whatever below that. Like, that's the threshold for seeing benefits from a cold plunge. And 58 is not that, I mean, it'll feel cold,
yeah,
but your body's gonna feel a lot better hanging out for a couple of minutes at 58 degrees than it will for 30 seconds at 34 or 35 degrees, like some people like to do.
Yeah, and I think I love the sober principle and also the sauna studies like coming out of the north, but when it comes to these things, there's so many other factors at play,
yeah,
especially for something like cold plunging. Think about a 50 degree cold plunge when it's 70 degrees outside versus a 50 degree cold plunge when it's like 50 degrees outside. Yeah. Those are very different experiences.
100%.
One of them, you get out and you know I'm going to be sunbathing.
Yep.
Like, there's no way that has the same effect as I'm getting out and I'm still in fight or
flight.
Still
cold.
I'm still cold. I'm still like seeking shelter. So there's a lot of variables there that I think, just like with Ketone IQ, we haven't explored all this.
Yeah.
So I am stoked to see how that comes out.
And I'm really big on N of one research. Like, I'll tinker on myself. I'll figure it out. I'll look at data and make decisions. And it's one of the interesting things with me with cold plunging, and I would have guessed totally the opposite, is that I am more comfortable in a cold plunge when the air temperature is colder.
Really?
Yeah. Like, there is something when the sun is on me, on your head, and it's 70 degrees out, and I'm in cold water, like, my body and mind cannot just sink into the cold.
Right.
But once it's like kind of, if it's 40 degrees outside and the water is 50 degrees, like, I'm fine. I can stay in way longer.
Yeah. I think that makes sense because, I mean, there is definitely something to the water feels colder when it's warm out.
Yeah. Right?
Because there's more contrast.
Yep.
So maybe that's part of it, is like, since they're kind of at equilibrium, you find more comfort,
I guess. Yeah. Having, you know, more recently than not gotten into cold plunging in the past year, like, I would have guessed the total opposite, because I like being warm and sunny, right? Like I like laying in the sun like a cat.
You say that, but yet you're the king of South Park. Like, I mean, you live up in the mountains.
I live in like the coldest place in Colorado.
It's cold. It's windy like all the time.
Oh, so we had a wind advisory this morning as I drove down, and I didn't know if the highway would be open. It was so windy.
Oh, gosh. You know I got blown off that highway.
Did you really? I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
I was living in Lady May, that big truck.
Yeah.
Kind of had a tall camper on it. And it just took us. It took Willow was in the front seat and I was in the driver's seat. And it just placed us 90 degrees. So we're perpendicular to the road up on one of those snow blanks. There was just nothing I could do.
Nothing.
It took a Ford F-250 and just went, you're over here now.
Yeah, this is where you live now.
I've never seen wind like that in my life.
It is so bad. And it's one of the few places that they will totally close that highway.
They should.
For ground blizzards.
Yeah.
And that's a term I never, or snow squall, or there's a bunch of terms for it, but I never heard of it until I lived in South Park. And it's basically the wind is so strong, it's taking the snow that's on the ground and blasting it across the highway, and it's total whiteout.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of what it was. It was a graveyard. I'm talking about every 15 feet, there was another car
just spun
out, placed. I mean, some of them placed way off the road.
Yeah, I had a topper ripped off my old truck driving through there.
Just, like the clamps?
Yeah, it just took everything. It just ripped it right off.
Yeah, it's a gnarly place. But I will say about that 285 drive from here, if I have somebody come into town and they've never like felt the mountain essence, I'll drive from here to Buena Vista and I'll just be like,
this is it.
Like, just feel this. Like, man, we don't even have to get out of the car. Nope. You can feel it. It's visceral.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's two spots on that drive that will just take your breath away the first time you ever do it. And hopefully more than that. To this day, it's coming off of Kenosha Pass.
Yep, that's the first one.
It opens up and you're like, oh my God. And then the other one is as you come around the corner into BV, when you get the collegiates in front of you and you see Mount Harvard for the first time, and you're like, oh my God, I get goosebumps thinking about just like, man, I live here. Like,
it's amazing.
This is cool. Like, I was afraid 10 years ago when I moved to Colorado that the allure of the mountains would wear off. I was like, man, what if, because I lived in Chicago and I grew up in Iowa, and coming to the mountains was something special. I did it once a year maybe. And I was like, man, like, I hope I never take this for granted. And now 10 years later, waking up and getting to see, you know, the Mount Harvards and they got the Calibron right by me, or Sherman. It's like, dude, I get goosebumps thinking about like how cool it is and how special it is and how privileged it is that I live 20 minutes from any of those peaks.
It's amazing. And one of my favorite views in Colorado is when the sun sets behind that ridgeline with Sherman, the DeKalb Run, basically behind Alma, and the light reflects, and it's an alpen glow, and it goes over the valley and
the whole fair valley.
Play, and it just gets this bright pink.
Yep.
Oh my God. And then there's like a horse walking in the pasture, and the background's just straight pink cotton candy.
Yeah, if you go through Fair Play, like heading towards BV, you go up on a hill, and if you hang out, it's on that drive to Sherman. If you hang out on that hill and just kind of just watch the sunset over Fair Play, it's a special place, man. I want to get the drone up someday and get some like time lapse of the color change over the town.
How did that? Why is it called South Park?
So we're in Park County, and we're the south side of Park County.
Oh, okay. My guess, I was always thinking about that, and I was like, it's like kind of like, I was thinking of it like the park would be Rocky Mountain National, and this is like a south version of like another mountainous area, right? Like Alma is like a south version of Rocky Mountain. That was my guess.
Yeah, it's as far as I know, like I'm not a historian, but
Park County.
We're in Park County, and it's the south side of it, and so that's kind of generally known as South Park. So Fair Play, Hartzell, Alma, technically all considered South Park.
Very cool. Yeah, I like that area. I've looked a lot at like getting a spot down in Hartzell. There's just like such good climbing and running, and I don't know.
The challenge with Hartzell is there's just so much like treeless land there.
Yeah.
That you have to be pretty careful about like the land you're looking at, because you'll go show up to a 40-acre plot and look at it and there's not a single tree on it.
It's
and you're like, why would I buy 40 acres of treeless land unless I just wanted to have cattle or
a
something?
Farm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not getting into the farming game.
I'm not either.
Speaking of that, you still vegan?
I'm not
vegetarian.
I was plant-based for 2 years.
Oh, you're not.
I have just added chicken back into my diet.
Dude, let's go.
it's actually kind of a funny story as to why.
Okay.
So I was racing in Hawaii, in Kauai, back in August. And so I've been plant-based for 2 years at that point. And I don't know if you know much about Hawaii, but they don't do vegetables in Hawaii.
Hmm.
Like, it's meat or
fruit.
And I had just run 50 miles, had a really tough race, and I just needed some, like, real protein, and I was just so desperate. And you just, like, when you're kind of intuitive with your body, you just know what it needs. And I was like, I need a lot of protein right now. And so I was like, okay, well, let's see what happens. So I ordered up some chicken from a place, and it settled really well.
Wow.
I had no issues. And so I was like, okay, you know, we'll enter chicken back into the diet. And I've been really glad that I did lately. It's been a good change back. So I've had chicken and turkey, but I started this whole plant-based thing because my body doesn't process red meat well.
Mm.
And I just kind of wanted to do all or nothing for a while. And I knew eventually I'd probably go back to chicken and poultry and stuff like that. And, you know, now's the time. So I'll never have red meat again, just because it like really destroyed my sleep, and it destroyed how I ran, just because I process it so slowly. So my recovery metrics were bad. But chicken, I don't have a problem with. So
cool.
I'm glad to be back, and it makes eating out a whole lot easier.
What kind of chicken did you get for your first one? Like, was it like strips, or was it like a chicken breast?
It was chicken fried rice or chicken pad thai or something. It was from the Asian food cart.
Asian joint.
Like, it was just right down the road from the race. And I was
probably
just,
chicken thigh.
Yeah.
Probably
so thigh. So high fat.
Yeah.
Which I that's pretty much all I ate previously when I was eating chicken. It was just chicken thighs.
I love chicken thighs.
Dude, same. They taste so good. They're cheap, and they're high fat. Like, they're good fuel.
Yeah, they're great in like any kind of bowl. You know, some chicken thigh with rice.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's
like, that's basically what I had. So it went well. So I'm back on the meat eating train.
I honestly didn't know that. I was just thinking about meat, and I was like, I wonder if Don's still a vegetarian.
No, man. I'm glad not to be. I never, like, some people go for ethical reasons, and I respect that. I was never there. I was doing it for performance only. Recovery metrics, like I said before, I'm an N of one guy. The sleep data said not to eat meat, and then blood draws, I got regular blood draws. It kept saying that I was fine not eating meat, and then, you know, some of the metrics were starting to say, hey, maybe I should reconsider it anyways. So it'd been on my mind. And then I didn't want to have a bowl of pineapple after a 50-mile race in Kauai. And I was like, yeah, bring on the chicken.
That's incredible that you've done so much tracking with your own body, like in terms of all the blood work and the data.
It's just helpful. Like, we live in a time now that you have access to everything. If you want to optimize yourself as an athlete, like, look at it. Like, yeah. I'll say this time and time again, I'm not a super talented athlete, but I'm going to nurse every ounce of talent I have out of my body and give it whatever it needs to allow me to perform how I want it to.
Yeah. David and I was just talking about that with him, which is like, I'm such a squid naturally compared to everyone I race against. Like there's so many people who are just like specimens, and they just like, they have something that I don't have.
Yeah.
It's like, you got to try and make up for it somewhere, like with grit and mindset and training hard. Like, there's only so much you can do in order to overcome a lack of natural prowess.
Totally. And I mean, ultra distance stuff definitely precludes itself to athletes that aren't necessarily as physically talented, but are willing to work harder than the next guy.
Like, that's a good point.
I never... Like, my 5K PR is like 18 and a half minutes, and I've really only run under 20 minutes a couple times. Never did it in high school, never did it in college. Not a talented runner, but I'll work harder than most people.
Yeah, I think that's my same, like, PR. Yeah. Same story on my 5K.
Yeah, it's like, and I know, and I'm not here saying that that's not a good 5K time. I think a lot of people would be ecstatic at that. But when you're talking elite level racing and trying to win races, that is quite slow.
it's not very good. No, a lot of the guys I'm competing against run like 15 minute 5Ks.
Yeah, those high rocks guys are dropping 15 minute 5Ks.
Yeah.
And then they can deadlift 450.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the hell?
Yeah, it'll never be me.
No.
But you kind of got to come to terms with what you've got.
Totally.
You know, whether it's in your talent as like an athlete or your position in like a professional world or in a family unit. It's like you're going to have natural proclivities, and you're just going to have to kind of double down on your strengths and use those for what they are.
100%. Yeah. And ultra stuff, it requires a lot of different strengths. Obviously physical talent helps, but like there's a lot of different things in ultra racing that you can train for that aren't necessarily like gifted to you. And so that's just kind of where I've found myself. I'll work as hard as I need to be successful. And, you know, I hope that I can continue for a bunch more years being competitive.
Yeah. That brings up a good point. There's one thing I think about in like mountain racing that has helped me is like the survival and wilderness background. Like I've run with, especially lately, one or two of my friends who are way more talented runners than I am. And they've never done multi-day runs or even full-day runs. So like the idea of being in the woods deep in the backcountry overnight in a compromised position is like scary as hell to them. They could smoke me in 100.
Yep.
But for them being in that position versus us who like spend a lot of time in the mountains, and that doesn't even really cross your mind.
Well, that came into play at your recent 100 miler, right? The weather there turned quickly.
Yeah.
So I'd love to flip the script here a little bit. Like I saw some pictures and that looked like, is it like hailed or sleeted on you guys in the middle of the night? Were you prepared for that? And like, how did you keep moving forward through that?
So it was in Canyonlands. Yep. So kind of like desert canyons. Lap one's pretty beautiful, like 50 degrees. Lap two, it starts raining on me and I'm in a cutoff and it's just pouring rain. But I was like, I was 50 miles in. I felt great. I was cruising still. I was like, this is awesome. Probably like my high, right? Yep. I'm running in the rain, having a great time. I stop there. I pick up my first pacer, Mitch, and we go out and we get dumped on hail. Yeah. You know, that lap before, I had just had lightning strike right next to me. So I was like, kind of like freaked out a little bit about that. So it hailed, blowing sideways rain for the next 26 miles. And I come in and that's when I was like getting tired, like that 78 mark.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, it's dark out. My crew was trying to get clothes on me, but I was kind of like, I was like, I don't want this or that. And so I put on one t-shirt, a sweatshirt and high running shorts and got out and was about to leave, went into the porta potty to pee and realized I was freezing.
Yeah.
And so I came back. Lauren's like, you have to wear pants, you know, like get some pants on me. And I go out and it gets colder and colder. We're watching. So there's no dropping.
Mm-hmm.
It's helicopter rescue only, because in the backcountry, there's no way to get cars out there. So we're watching people drop left and right. The leader gets pulled for hypothermia. I mean, it gets bad fast.
Yeah.
Like it's just diabolical at this point. And I'm doing great. I'm with my buddy Ren, my second pacer at this point. We drop down into a canyon. And all of a sudden, I go hypothermic because of the cold sink, and I just start hallucinating. I'm just seeing animals everywhere. I'm like, bunny. And he's like, he just kept going.
Wait, bro, now.
He go, just me and you, bud. Just me and you, bud. That's all he was saying. I was like, fish. Like, all these things were coming up out of the ground, and I was just shaking, jackhammering, just like trying to move forward. Dude. And Ren was like, he was telling me the other day, we sat down and had a beer, and he was like, dude, I was scared.
Yeah.
He's like, I can't carry him out. He's like, we're 15 miles from help. There's no way to get out of this. And, you know, it's just one of those situations, man, where
hallucinations fascinate me.
So cool.
Because it's, I don't know, were you prepared for hallucinations? Like, did you, like, okay.
So I'm a big hallucinator.
I kind of figured. Yeah. it's the first time I ever hallucinated, I was not prepared for it.
Oh, and you
I
hadn't done it.
Freaked out. In a race, and I was like, I thought the first time I remember it so vividly, I thought the whole forest was made of pants. So it was just like like khakis and jeans and stuff like that. And I was like what the hell?
Oh my God.
And then I thought, like, occasionally I thought the trees were other runners and I would start following them. And then I would just literally run into a tree. And this was in a last man standing race. And so I just like, I was so freaked out. I finally got back to the loop and I was like, my crew couldn't calm me down. They couldn't get me to go back out. I was so freaked out. And then so once I kind of then studied hallucinations and understood like what is happening, your body's kind of going, your brain is going into dream state a little bit, and it's filling in gaps, and it's seeing like when the shadows start coming, it just interprets stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like really, really crazy stuff. And so Cocodona this year, my 250 mile race earlier this year, man, I hallucinated so bad. The second night, I kept hearing noises, and I'd never had audible hallucinations before.
Yeah.
And this is my first experience with audible hallucinations. And I was like, what in the hell is that? And I would turn around, and then the whole desert floor was just covered in hedgehogs. And that I was convinced that hedgehogs were coming after me, and I was in danger.
Oh, my God.
And luckily, I was my pacer at the time, I wouldn't have guessed it, but he actually handled it quite well.
Okay.
And he was just like, you know, hey, like, they're not there. Like, it's okay. And we were like 10 miles away from my camper where I was going to take a nap anyways. And he got me through it, but it was, I'll never forget the funniest thing. Cause I'm like, dude, like every time I turn around, it's just hedgehogs are coming after me. And he just goes, well, maybe stop turning around. I was like, all right, man.
Good point.
Yeah. Good point. And then the second or the third night, the whole forest, all of the trees turned into like perfectly manicured faces. Mm. Like it's like somebody went with a trimming thing and trimmed in faces. And it was like literally every shadow to me would turn into a face. And to this day, and I've hallucinated a little bit since then, even in my last 24 hour, like everything my brain tries to interpret into faces. And it's so weird. So I super vividly remember that the most memorable tree I saw looked like Shrek. Shrek's head, and on top of Shrek's head was the Tin Man from Wizard of Oz's head.
Huh.
And it was just like a totem of those two. And they like their faces just followed me.
It's like something deep in your childhood is like throwing out these little thoughts.
Yeah. So I'm now fascinated with hallucinations, and
I am too.
Like, I think it's really cool when your brain starts like losing itself, where does it revert back to?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so like where does hedgehogs come from?
Yeah,
I have no idea.
It's just your brain trying to do its best. Like,
yeah.
When I saw duck, fish, and rabbit. That's what it was, duck, fish, and rabbit, because basically on the stones there was white.
Yep.
And so the white would catch a little moonlight, and it would basically be pitch black out, and then something white would happen, and my brain would just take in an instant.
That's what that is.
Bang, that's a clownfish, and then I would see the clownfish
It goes,
you know, and then it was just like picking things out that my brain knew and applying it to the situation 100%. To try and identify it.
It fills in gaps really well. And
it's so weird.
And I'll see like a couple of races. I'll see like, oh, there's a race photographer. And you'll run up and like, oh, no, it's a stump. Yeah. Because it's like, okay, in my brain, that makes sense that there's a race photographer out here.
Yeah.
And like there's weird shadows. I'm like, oh, look at the photographer.
And they're kind of bent down.
Yeah. Oh, nope, just a stump. And I that's probably the most common for me at the end of long races when I do get into that state. It's like just, I think there's people of some kind out just cheering. And it's like, oh, no, it's either a big rock or a stump.
Yeah. I've had a lot of them, and I'm pretty cool with them now because I've gotten comfortable with it. But the Colorado Trail was the weirdest thing for me, having auditory hallucinations. So I found this really cool camping spot under a waterfall. And so I'm doing it completely unsupported, completely solo. It's day four. I've got COVID. I don't know it at this
That's
point.
That's right.
Or no, it's the end of day two. I've got COVID and I didn't know it at this point. And what I kept hearing was, if you go on the iPhone alarm, you can do one that's birds chirping.
Yeah.
It's a very distinct bird chirping. Mm-hmm. And I was laying down. I was like, oh, the alarm's going off on my phone. And I looked. I'm like, okay, the alarm's not going off. Someone must have like hung a food bag and left their phone
convinced.
In it. And they're right. So I get out of my bivvy and I'm just searching. I'm like up on this cliffside, like up on this waterfall, like, where's their food bag? And the alarm just kept going off. I'm like, all right. I took all my electronics out. I laid them out and like turned them all off. And I'm like, because it would the alarm would go off and then it would go away. Alarm would go off. I didn't sleep the entire night. 0 hours of sleep.
Oh my God.
I laid there in my bivvy and I woke up the next day and I had to push across the CDT. So get up really high, battle the wind. I'm like 20 miles into the day and I'm on the middle of this huge escape of mountains and I hear it again. And I'm like, mother.
God damn it, it's back.
It was fake the whole time.
Yeah.
It was never real.
Oh,
it was
that's so hard coming
out of it. I had never had like you know, hallucinating sound without hallucinating visually.
It was just the auditory.
Ears.
Yeah.
So bizarre.
That was my hedgehogs, because like looking forward, it was just auditory. There was nothing to alert me to it. And then turning around is when the visuals. And it was so weird. And
wait, could you hear them?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's terrifying.
That was the noise. It was the, I guess I didn't explain it. It was like scurrying noise behind me.
Oh God, that's terrifying.
It was like, imagine the sound of like 1,000 rats coming at you. And it was just like scurrying.
Oh no.
And I would turn around and then the forest or the desert floor was all hedgehogs.
Okay, that's really scary.
Yeah, it was freaking me
out,
man.
Birds chirping is one thing.
No, but... and then I would look forward and there was nothing but the sound. And then I would look back and I would see them. And it was just weird how the brain was like, oh no, we're going to piece this puzzle together. Like,
that's
if,
so terrifying.
If he's going to hear it, it's going to be. And then, so actually the other funny story of going back, I get a kick out of this, that the first hallucination experience I had when I was looking at the pants in the forest and I was running into trees. One of my, this again, last man standing race, one of my fellow competitors heard me tell my crew that I was like, I'm running into trees. And like, we're all a little loopy at this point. We've been running for like 38 hours. And he just goes, get him a helmet. Like that was his, it's a funny story now. Like, okay, like looking back, like that was probably a good solution. Put a helmet on me and send me back out there.
So tell me a little bit about what you got in the pipeline. What's going on for Don in the end of this year and into 2024?
Yeah, so I'm focusing on, I just launched my own business agency focusing on community building for small brands and connecting them to established business or established communities and just really trying to bring people together through sport and products. So that's really my focus right now. I'm taking a little bit of an off season from training, which was much, much needed. I did, you know, one race this year was 190 miles, a 250-mile race, the 24 hours, which is almost 130 miles. I put a lot of miles on my body this year, so I'm taking a few weeks off of running.
Good for you.
Which is much overdue. I'm focusing on the business a little bit, and then I actually just built out my schedule, my A schedule for next year. So I have another 24-hour race in June. That one will be unique because it's indoors.
Whoa.
It's on a 500-meter track indoors.
Whoa.
So there'll be some unique challenges there. But it's a temperature controlled lit arena. Mm. So it's actually an ice arena. So the indoors is held at a perfect 55 degrees, which is perfect for me, especially training in South Park. And then I tend to get really sleepy when it gets dark. So running in a fully lit arena for 24 hours could be interesting.
Yeah.
We'll find out, right? So that'll be fun. And then the back half of the year, I'm going to focus getting back into big mountain running, with Run Rabbit Run 100 up in Steamboat being my A focus for the last half of the year. But that the 24 is definitely the focus. I'm going to start up training. I've been running a little bit, and I think there's an important differentiation between running and training.
Yeah.
Like I've been running. I've been moving my body. I've been in the gym. I've been doing stuff. Training starts next week.
Right.
Which is like, there's a plan. There's stuff on a piece of paper. And I'm looking at the metrics. Now it's just like, hey, I feel like running. I'm going to go out the door, get 6-8 miles in with my dogs.
What, do you have a coach?
I do. Yeah. Yep.
And then, you know, what is his background? Is it ultra running or is it?
So he's an elite marathoner. And then a really damn good ultra athlete. So he was just on the U.S. 24-hour team at the World Championships this past weekend. He was third at Leadville this past year. His name's Scott Traer. He's been where I'm trying to get in my late 30s. Mm-hmm. He's in his early 40s now, and in his late 30s to early 40s, he's accomplished pretty much all the things that I want to accomplish in those same years. So what better person to work with than somebody that's been literally where you are want to go. So so I work with him. We're on a little break right now. I'm just doing my own thing for a couple of weeks. I think that's really important. Even if you're working with a coach, take a month to yourself.
Mm.
Like a coach doesn't need to tell you to take a rest.
Yeah.
Like so
tell you how to run with your dogs.
No, like I think that's like use a coach for when you want to buckle down and go hard, because a coach yes, they program things, but they also tell you, hey, maybe you've gone a little too hard lately. You've done too much. Like, your recovery metrics are not great. Let's take a rest week, which is what I need most from a coach. Because, right, like, you know, type A athlete, we want to go hard all the time. And sometimes the best thing you can do for your body is, hey, like, maybe run at 10-minute pace for an hour or two and go real easy.
Yeah, I've learned that. I got my first coach, and I've learned that that every day shouldn't be hard. Like, correct. I used to think, like, I would train every day, twice a day.
No.
And most days I would be going really, really hard.
Yep.
And I wasn't, like, everything was fine, but I wasn't getting that much better. And now I've actually pulled it back, and I've gotten,
isn't, like, that crazy?
Significant jumps.
Yeah, everybody, if you operate in the, like, just the hard area or just the middle zone and hard, and you're not using, like, really, really easy days, you're not training right.
Right.
Because you, if you're going easy on some days, your hard days can be way harder.
Yeah.
The, like, intensity, you can hammer.
Yes.
And so that's, I mean, look at Eloy Kipchoge, the only person ever to run a marathon under 2 hours. So that's what, 4:34 pace or something like that for 26.2 miles. His easy days are like 10-minute pace. Right? Like, so there's something to be said about, like, go super easy. Like, I mean, I'm talking, for me, that's like 115 to 120 heart rate on my easy days, which in, you know, 10,000 feet is 10 to 11 minute pace.
Yeah.
And I can then go out to the track the next day and just destroy myself.
Yeah. You got to have those easier days in order to hit the intensity that you want to hit.
Yep.
All right, man. Well, this has been amazing. I always love having
jumped
you
around
in.
A bit. I love it.
We could freaking sit in here for just so long.
Just riff and keep going off of different topics. I love it.
But give people, like, a little bit of update about the bench and where to find you and what you got coming up.
Yeah, so I kind of, as a joke, started this series called Tiny Bench Big Questions. I'm going to tell the story of how that came to be at some point on my social media, but I put everything... I put all the full interviews of those on YouTube. It's just at Run With Don on YouTube. And then my main social media is at Run With Don on Instagram. I put the trailers and shorts of the Tiny Bench on Instagram. Just got done interviewing Ryan earlier today. But yeah, it's just the idea with Tiny Bench Big Questions is really cool people, deep questions for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, we're not throwing in fluff. We're just going to jump right into like what you do during your hardest moment and why.
Yeah.
It's cool. I love it. I learn a lot from high performers and what gets them through hard moments. And man, it started as a joke, but it's something that I love it. It's been fun.
I've had some good podcast experiences, you know, as a guest,
and
very bad ones. That was definitely one of the ones I enjoyed most.
Like, thanks, man.
There was just... You know, at first I wasn't really sure what to expect because it's a very different format. But
it's so different.
It's just, it's so nice. It's just like, here are the main points that we're trying to get to. There's no fluff. It's like,
it's
boom,
like cliff,
boom, boom.
Cliff notes for a podcast.
Yeah, and cliff notes for a podcast.
And there's something about, so if you haven't seen it, we sit on this pretty tiny little bench.
Yeah.
I mean, we're pretty intimately close. And I
think our asses were touching.
Literally. Like, we are on top of each other to some degree. And I think there is something to be said, and there is some psychology behind, like, the closer you sit to somebody, the more, like, open and intimate you feel with them.
Mm.
And I it's been my experience that, like, I'll ask questions of people on that bench that I would never ask day to day. And I feel like people are telling things on that bench that you wouldn't just volunteer day to day. Because there is that, like, the layers have been removed and we are just really two people really close to each other, and there's this weird intimate energy that goes on that little bench that the conversations have been so good.
Yeah, I mean, I just told some stuff that maybe wouldn't naturally tell people,
right?
That's a incentive to go watch that, because I spilled the beans.
Yeah we got into some shit there.
Oh, that's amazing.
That might be a teaser.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, Don, thank you for having me and coming to do my podcast. A little two for one action.
Such a good morning. I appreciate you, man.
And everyone else, we'll talk to you next time. Stay wild.